This is The Shape of Education to come. Maggie McIntosh, tell me what you do.
I am the education reporter at the Winnipeg Free Press. I've been in this role for exactly a year now, and it has been quite a tumultuous year for education, one I definitely never expected when I took on the role in January 2020. So I was just thinking about the last year and how crazy it's all been. The last 12 months have been quite a time for Manitoba education. So,
do you think that's unique to education, or is that just everything?
Well, it's funny because I think that, like, definitely education is one of the sectors that has seen the biggest shift. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe I am conceited in the sense that I think so much has happened in this field, but because I document things on a daily basis, mm-hmm. I look at some of the work that my other colleagues have been doing. And, you know, crime is obviously a pretty popular beat. And it seems like, you know, perhaps for the good, there has been, it's been a quieter year for crime. It's been for my colleagues who cover crime, it's been a quieter year for, like my colleague who covers climate change. I mean, it shouldn't be, but it has been, just in terms of the viewership. And I look at, our stats on the website, and I think the education stories have been like skyrocketing. So I think that, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think obviously health has had an unprecedented year, but I think education is up there with quite a crazy, chaotic year that we've had.
You know, that was my feeling too, like when I think about the news, but I wasn't sure if that was just my own self-selecting of news.
Your bubble, yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
And I wondered too, like, there was a time when there wasn't an education reporter for a couple of years. So also, like, mm-hmm. there's literally someone to do that now too. But
exactly.
it does seem like that
very
is
good timing.
Out there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Okay, so you're not a teacher, and usually I am talking with teachers. But I think that there are at least certain similarities in what we do. So, like, first of all, I think that there is this idea of truth behind what both of us does. And we'll come to that. But there's also mm-hmm. the idea, I think, both of our jobs, and you might say I'm totally wrong, are really relationship-based. So in thinking about, like, your audience, I assume you want all of Manitoba to be your audience. But do you have a sense of who your audience, like, particularly represents? Like, is it certain groups who you find are really following you, like teachers or parents or people who are just angry and want to complain about paying taxes?
I guess that depends on what my perhaps teacher Twitter sphere is versus my email inbox, because obviously I get some more frustrated messages sometimes, or some messages of applause. And I would think that the people who are typically reaching out to me are either longtime readers of the Free Press who are really are excited about having an education reporter, and it's often also educators, parents, less so students, and that's sort of one of the or typical students, because I guess we're talking about this sort of context where we're both educators in some sort of way, synthesizing information and educating people mm-hmm. about the latest, then everyone really is a student, including us, I think, too, because we have to obviously learn before we disseminate information yeah. out there. So I think that all of like our readership and who's reading the Free Press stories it's quite a wide range, but I definitely want more of a younger crowd to be reading the paper too, because I think it's important. And that's why I have really wanted to focus on amplifying student voices this year, is when I took on the role of education mm-hmm. reporter, is to make sure we're talking to young people, because in a typical classroom, obviously students are just as much a part of that as the educators, the educational assistants, the school staff, the teachers.
Do you have a sense of what people care most about in education? Like, what are the stories that people seem to really want to hear about?
Well, I actually was looking through some of the top stories that the top readership, or I guess the stories that I wrote in 2020 that had the most clicks or the most likes, reading time, et cetera. And the top story for K-12 education that I wrote this year was about the teachers and the state of anxiety throughout the pandemic,
yeah.
which was it's sort of a tricky line when you have anonymous sources, but obviously given the nature of how sensitive it has been for teachers, talking about mental health in general, there's so much stigma. And so I talked to 7 teachers for this particular feature, 2 of whom went on leave this year because of the stresses of the pandemic, and just outlining the details about their experiences. I know I had a few people reach out to me to say there was one line in particular, a teacher at the beginning, who talks about tailgating. She started to tailgate this year, and she was joking about tailgating and what that actually means to her and her colleagues, is going to their cars and crying over the lunch hour. So I think, it's not really a surprise in a lot of ways when you think that was the top story. I think there were 11,000 views on that one, but the reading time was 3 minutes, which is pretty good. So I think that people want to know what's really going on in the classroom, and so it's no surprise that stories like that get such a wide reach, because most of us don't spend 8 hours in a classroom all day. And so I think going into this role, also one of the things I wanted to do this year was visit as many schools as possible, get into classrooms, watch actual lessons, and talk to teachers and students who are in schools every day. And so I think that people have taken to that. And yeah, so that was the top story for 2020.
There's like half a dozen questions in that I want to pull apart, which I can't all do simultaneously. Would you call that a top story for you personally? I as a teacher, we can kind of see other teachers teaching and say what's exemplary. Would you call that like a personal example of exemplary writing for you?
I think that because it's a sort of journalism award season, and I've had to go through and look through all of my work and watch my personal growth, professional growth in the last year, and watch all these stories that I've covered pre and mid pandemic. So this is all fresh in my mind. And actually, I think my favorite story that I worked on this year was I had the chance to go just sit in a classroom for an entire school day. And it's stories like that that I really enjoyed doing, and I think are, I guess, if I'm humbly saying, exceptional, I think, because it's something unique. I mean, it was back in, I believe it was November, at Governor Semple School. I literally sat in one of those tiny grade 3 chairs, the mini chairs that students sit in, for an entire day and just sort of watched and observed. And that I thought was exceptional in the sense that it really did provide people a day in the life type experience. So that was probably my favorite story this year, I would think, or last year rather.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. It's so rare that we do get to see that.
Yeah.
And to get a glimpse in. So I've really enjoyed that. And I was actually calculating, went through all of my stories this year, and I visited more than 35 schools, and that's given within the pandemic restrictions. So I thought that was pretty good that I was able to get into 35 schools.
That is super surprising, actually. I know you talked about that one, you've talked to students, but I'm surprised it's actually been that many. That makes me wonder how you do come across stories. I mean, I'm guessing you're not hiding in the bushes outside of schools waiting for them to happen. So,
I don't think divisions would like that.
So how does parents. Yeah. What is the genesis of a story for you then?
Well, I think that the best stories come from conversations and being in schools and on the grounds. I obviously read a lot of education content and authors. There's an Education Writers Association based in the US that I follow, and I often see what different writers are writing about and get stories that way. And I read the Globe and Mail and their education stories and the New York Times. Some of my favorites, and the Washington Post has some really good education story content as well. So looking at what other people are doing and asking questions about, oh, is that happening here in Winnipeg? That's definitely an idea processing machine. That's one way to get stories and to think about things. I think that, and this is not unlike the field of teaching, but you have to be so inquisitive and curious as a journalist. It's so intertwined with the job. And so constantly asking questions is pretty much always how I get my stories. And that especially happens in school buildings. So, like for, what's a recent example? I guess I was talking on the phone. So this wasn't actually on the ground in the school, but talking with the superintendent about the remote learning process back in, must have been May. And we were just talking about how things have been working in rural divisions. And then I learned that it wasn't actually a new thing in their division. And then that's sort of how it snowballed into the story about how, oh, the Hutterite schools, colony schools, have been using remote learning software for decades. This is not new, and they're experts in this field. And that was a really unique story. I thought just having a conversation with someone and realizing, hey, oh, this isn't new for you guys. You guys are probably one of the only people on this planet who are so familiar with this way of teaching. So yeah, I guess conversations, asking questions, and reading lots.
Well,
always reading.
And you mentioned that reading part, like looking at other writers across, you know, North America or the world or wherever, and wondering, does that happen here? So what, when you think of those other places compared to here, what do you notice? Is there any differences in terms of education that you're noticing from like your perspective?
What is really interesting to me is because I grew up in Ontario's public education system. So there have been surprisingly, and I'm a fairly recent graduate. I graduated grade 12 in 2015. So that really wasn't that long ago. I'm a very early career journalist. Mm-hmm. I think that there are definitely some, I guess, bonuses and some negatives and positives in that because I am so fresh. And I have the ability to compare because I remember so clearly what it was like to be in high school. Mm-hmm. To when I talk to students here, I think so much has changed in those 5 years, either that or Manitoba's far ahead, the Hamilton School Board I grew up in, because I had pre-pandemic, I decided that I would do my own mini education review, and I visited 12 classrooms across the province. It was mostly in Winnipeg, but 12, actually it was more than 12. I wanted to visit every grade. So I went to 2 kindergarten classes, 1 full kindergarten, 1 half day. And then I went to grade 1 all the way up to 12 class in different, every single classroom was in a different school division or a different school or a different part of the province. I went to Portage. I went to Lorette, all over Winnipeg. And then I wrote stories after sort of spending an hour in the class and talking to different parents and teachers, and students. In that particular grade to write a little synopsis about what that grade is like. And even though I, you know, graduated 6 years ago, there were so much had changed. I mean, this idea of physical literacy in physical education programs was something I'd never even heard of. And I thought that was really interesting and unique. And perhaps it's only happening in Manitoba. I doubt it. I feel like it's, you know, a movement, in other areas of the world, but this idea that, you know, gym class, which it isn't called gym class, it's physical education, PE, but very, you know, there's such a focus now on getting students to learn how to love to exercise and to exercise and to exercise, not to play sports like dodgeball in class constantly, but to actually understand how to be healthy. And so this whole idea of physical literacy was something really new to me. Even the wiggle stools was something I noticed in Manitoba, which I have never seen, and I haven't even really heard of them that much in Ontario either. But this idea of different flexible seating was something that I think is fairly new. The counting games, what are they called? It's like a game that I see everywhere. Oh, it'll come to me later. Anyway, the realization that there isn't just one way to learn math and that kids learn and count in different ways. That was something that was new that I've been seeing in Manitoba classrooms. So it's hard to know because I wasn't in grade 3 all that recently, but definitely over the last decade, I mean, there has been a massive shift in teaching. And I think that Manitoba is ahead in a lot of ways. Also consent. There were a lot of conversations I was having with students that ended up going back to consent and how they knew what consent meant. And they were learning, about consent in such positive ways, and they really had a good grasp on what that meant. And you know, whether you're talking about sex ed or any other part of growing up, I thought that was really important and sort of a cool theme about what's happening here in Manitoba classrooms and what's being talked about here.
Will you be releasing your mini education review at the same time that the government releases their education review?
You know, it's funny, Devin, it was so sad. I spent, like, I'm not exaggerating when I say a couple 70-hour work weeks putting this thing together, and I snuck into the grade 11 classroom on, like, the last day that schools were open, and it was going to be a big feature, and it ended up sort of being hidden in an addition back in, I guess it would have been March, and it was sort of the same week that everything was shutting down.
Right.
So it was sort of, it quietly went under the radar, but it's out there.
Okay.
It's Free Press Visits K-12 Classrooms, I believe it's called. And it was one of my favorite projects I worked on this year, but I don't think that many people knew about it because there was just so much going on this year.
Well, I'm sorry that I missed that too then.
I won't hold it against you.
So thinking of like the government, and mm-hmm. things they're going. And thinking about the relationship piece too, how do you see the relationship between you and the people that you're reporting on? So, like, I'm thinking specifically about the government. And I'm imagining a situation where mm-hmm. The government might leak something. So, and actually, it reminds me of when it was in mid-December, like, there's the kind of early test balloon float of schools going remote or extending the vacation. And that kind of came out.
Oh, was that the story that we had published and then a week later they announced it?
Yeah, something like that.
After the Free Press was like, sources. Yeah, that's so dramatic.
I don't know, maybe it's not how that happened in this case. But in that relationship, like, I can imagine sometimes that you might be used as a test balloon. And so it's absolutely newsworthy, but also it's serving their purpose as much as yours. Is that problematic for you? Am I overthinking that?
Well, Devin, I wish that was the case. I wish that I was getting secret government tips. I don't think I've ever, it's funny. I got a lot of student, when I was a student journalist, a lot of, sort of student politicians would leak things, and I feel like it's very much played out in movies that people think that happens a lot more than it does.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm just too green in the field that I don't have any government sources yet. For the most part, I mean, I have developed quite the roster of give and take relationships with sources who have been so generous with their time and helping me understand the Manitoba education system and walking me through things. And so that was a situation where we had heard something. I think there was a belief that there was going to be a switch. There was going to be some sort of buffer period. And I knew there was a meeting happening. And then I reached out to some education sources and they sort of confirmed, yes, this is what happened in the meeting, et cetera. And then that we ran with that because we had verified it. And then the next week, the province announced pretty much what we had reported. It's been difficult to get Kelvin Gertsen on the phone or to see him in person. I know he's a busy man. But I think the last time I actually had a long conversation with him, I bombarded him outside his office. It must have been back in June to ask him some questions about, I don't even remember what that was. Something about, I guess, the school closures, because the province had decided they were not going to reopen schools. But then they did in June. Maybe it was June. Honestly, the whole last year feels like such a blur. It feels like it was simultaneously in fast forward while also in slow motion. So I'm rambling on and on.
Well, okay.
It's funny, I interview people constantly, but I'm not the most eloquent interview subject.
So I certainly wasn't going to suggest that you did have a tip there. But in a case like that, where let's say you maybe did have, and you knew that you were being given this thing more for the government's benefit than for your benefit, like, is there a time when you would get something like that and not report on it? Or is part of that relationship where, you know, sometimes it's give and take?
I guess it depends what the sort of quote unquote tip would be. I find, for the most part, I'm like just filing a gazillion FIPA requests all the time to try and get information. And it's a lot of give. Rather, I'm giving them. I'm giving them lots of work.
Right.
I actually just got a recent FIPA back from the ombudsman's office to say that despite I had filed for the education review and they said, no, you can't have it. And then I appealed to the ombudsman to say, can I please have the education review? Is there any chance that, you know, they're interpreting the Freedom of Information legislation incorrectly? And then the ombudsman just told me, no, you have to wait like everybody else. So that was a sad gift.
If you had that, you couldn't report on it, could you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Information requests. It's a really powerful tool to get information from government about decision making. And if they would release it, then it would essentially become public. So we would, I'm sure many journalists would then get their hands on it, which is cool. It's been slow over the holidays. And so I obviously knew that would happen. So I filed a bunch of data information beforehand to set myself up. So I really love data journalism. I think there's so much we can learn about numbers and trends.
Yeah. And I guess part of that, but also maybe part of like, you know, what tips are worth pursuing for you, what counts as news? Because surely people send you lots of things and part of your job is going to be to sift through that, I'm assuming. And I think it was when the COVID numbers started getting really high, I think it was Melissa Martin who talked about how there were so many tips she was receiving from nurses and places like that were horrifying, but they were just no longer news because people had been hearing that already. They knew that, but it was just, it was the fact that it was still happening was itself not news. So for you, how do you decide what you are going to report on?
It's truly situation by situation, an email by email, conversation by conversation decision. It really depends on timing. The thing about news is, I think there's three pillars. It's like what's new, interesting. I think there's one more, maybe significant, unique. I really am drawn to really interesting, unique, first of its kind type stories. A journalism professor once told me, the best stories are the ones that only you know about. And so I sort of like to channel that quote when I'm thinking about stories, whether it is, what isn't being reported. I have such an advantage because I have my one beat that I'm plugged into all the time. So I'm constantly reading education content, talking to teachers, talking to educators, and in schools. So I think that there are often conversations I'll have that, spark my interest. And I think, oh, wow, no one's talked about that or no one knows about this. And those are sort of the stories that I think that's when I know it's a story, when I think, hey, I didn't know that, or when I learned something new. But then, of course, it's a tough one too, because with the province and obviously Manitoba education, anything really that Manitoba education does is news, I think. So that's, you've got different pockets of stories, your unique, interesting human interest stories, and then your government legislation, policy, decision-making type stories. And I think those are probably the two main categories and types of stories that I'm writing, although there is also that enterprise investigative journalism type of stories. And I've got a few interesting projects coming down the line there, which will be great.
Are those things you can talk about now? Those are not things you can, probably.
Those are a teaser. A teaser for the readers. Stay tuned to the Winnipeg Free Press.
What's an example of one of the thing that was like new to you kind of story?
This one is awesome and up there with one of my favorite stories this year, and it's pandemic related, so bonus point. Basically, one of my colleagues, his son's school, he sent me over the notice when he got the back to school plan, and he said, hey, check this out. And I was reading through it and I was looking at the list and I was like, whoa, color coded cohorts. First of all, say that 10 times fast. This is like so dystopian, but the school was doing a color-coded cohort situation where they wanted to make sure that kids were not mingling with different cohorts at recess. And so they were going to encourage students to wear a certain color throughout the year, and particularly at recess. And this is something that has happened in a few schools where they've had either pennies or hats. I think those are the two I've heard of. And then there was this other school. So I did a feature on the color-coded cohorts. And to go witness a recess at the, I think it was early September, to go witness a recess with these kids playing, and you see all the purple kids they're playing on the, on the playground structure, and then the students in blue are playing on the tarmac, and it was such a strange thing to witness. And that one had quite, it did pretty well with the readership too, because I think people must have agreed with me and thought, wow, this is so dystopian. Who would have ever thought that you'd be driving by a school and seeing these blobs of color, and it wasn't a game of Survivor or something, right? Like, this is truly just making sure that kids aren't mingling, and it was pretty wild to watch. And that, so that was a cool story that I stumbled on.
And also another example of like how much work you are doing out there that's getting reported on, because I think I'm pretty well read, but I missed that story completely. So like that you have really brought a lot to the field this year and make people aware of what's going on.
It's been crazy busy. Yeah, there are some days where it's 3-4 stories a day. Although I
have no sense if that's a lot.
I'm trying to take it easier. Yeah, like, that's a lot. That's I think it's a lot for me personally. I guess normally, I don't know. Is there a normal? I don't know. Most of the time, I mean, on a usual year, maybe 1-2 stories a day is sort of normal. It really depends on how long the stories are too, though.
You mentioned the clicks,
anyway,
too.
It's been like, a lot of writing.
How, you said 11,000 clicks. Is that, what's an average story? Like how many would that be? How many clicks?
Good question. Let's see here.
Is that data you're actually pulling up right now?
Yeah, we have a cool, I don't know what it's called, like a radar type system, because we want to gauge how our stories are doing, so we know if we're serving the readers or our readers or not, and what kind of stories they're interested in.
Maggie, that sounds dystopian to me. That sounds horrifying. I could never, like, if I had an app that showed me how successful I was in my job by the second, I think I would die of anxiety.
Yeah, it can be intimidating, but I think that that's sort of the way of the future with journalism. I mean, I've worked at CBC before, and we were definitely using the same sort of software, trying to gauge how, because a lot of the stuff comes down to a lot of the clicks and how well stories do comes down to headlines. It comes down to photo. It comes down to the very first line, the lead. There's so many different aspects. And so we want to make sure that when we are, you know, investing time to produce quality journalism, that we want to have as much readership as possible. We want people to read what we're putting out there. So, and, you know, it is intimidating, but it is, I think it's really cool too, to know, hey, the story did really well, or the story didn't do so well. So I don't know what the average, I guess, number would be of average clicks or readers, you know, on a story, but 10,000 would be pretty good, I would think, for like, I would think normally it's like around 8,000, 10,000 for the education stories that I write.
Okay.
Usually for K to, it's weird. I know sometimes post-secondary gets more, sometimes it gets less, because I cover everything from daycares and early childhood education all the way till master's degrees and apprenticeships. So
right.
It's quite a big swath of a beat.
Okay, so at the top of this, I mentioned the idea that, you know, we both are working the idea of what's true. Truth. And so that's interesting to me in how you would parse out truth. So you have lots of different, I guess, areas you can pull from. So you have like people's personal truths, whether it's, you know, a teacher or a student or, you know, whoever. And then maybe factual truths, which might be different. So for you, I have a feeling this is going to be a question that's made up of many questions. Who is a reliable source? What counts as real knowledge? You know, lots of teachers think they know what's going on and are confident that, you know, the number of times I heard that, oh, tomorrow we're going to Code Red. And it never happened. But people were sure they knew. And if you had asked them as a source, they would have told you that. And they're on the front lines, but maybe they do have some important angle. But then the politicians, like, they have relevant information too, but maybe it's distance from the actual context of teaching. I'm thinking of like the COVID school Twitter account, who's telling a very different story than I think the government is telling.
Right.
So in taking all that, you have to parse it and find truth. So like, what is true to report on?
Existential question, Devin. It's a big one. I think that truth, there are, I mean, that is why I went to journalism school, to figure out how to do all this in 4 years. There's so many different ways to fact check things, but obviously it does, you know, one of the basic ways is to simply gauge what the truth is in a conversation with someone. And I think that when we're having a conversation, we all have biases. And that's really important to think about, no matter who you're talking to, is where do they come from? You know, what is their experience? And to gauge that as you're talking to them, and to press them on questions that perhaps challenge their viewpoint. Also, I think it comes down to sort of a numbers game where you need to be, if it's a basic fact, you know, is it snowing outside? You're going to ask, if you can't be outside, you're going to ask 10 different people who are outside, is it snowing outside, and see what people are saying. Mm. But there's a good basic journalism sort of mantra that is, you know, you don't rely on someone to tell you if it's raining outside. You go outside yourself and find out. And so when we're doing fact-checking, when I'm doing fact-checking and writing, I'm trying to get as close as possible to the truth by talking at so many different perspectives, by doing research, and trying to get that firsthand experience too often. So whether that's, you know, showing up at a school, observing things, talking to a lot of people, a lot of different people. And that's important. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, somewhat. Yeah, it does. And it leads to something else I'm thinking about that you kind of mentioned before. Like we talked about the article with the tailgating and the granting of anonymity. So like as you're reporting and finding out, you know, what the truth is, I noticed, you know, almost across the board in stories of education, teachers are very rarely named. And it always says, you know, withholding identity as they feared repercussions from their employer. So obviously there's a balance there in giving a platform to someone who won't reveal their identity, but it's to protect them. So how do you decide if the person you're talking to is reliable? And are there cases where you wouldn't give anonymity to them?
Definitely. It is an extremely difficult decision. And I think, honestly, it makes me uncomfortable every time because it is having that first name, last name, title. It's a powerful thing when you're willing to put your name on the record on anything. I mean, it's a big decision. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of weight behind that. So when we are trying to decide whether or not someone should be able to speak out, and they can't speak out for whatever reason, and more often than not, when we're talking about educators, it is because of a fear of retribution at work. It is definitely a very careful decision that we have to make every time, a decision both with myself and my editors. And the thing about the pandemic is I've noticed a lot in the last 6 months or 8 months even, is there seem to be a lot more confidential sources. And I think that is because people are so scared to speak out. And it's sometimes the only way of being able to tell a story and what's going on. I mean, thinking back about the story with the teachers and anxiety, something that I've been hearing for weeks and weeks. And eventually, when everyone that you talk to is so, so terrified about losing their job, but this is something that is a trend that's clearly not uncommon in our schools, at that point, you know, when you're hearing this so often, you realize, okay, we need to tell this story. And if this is the only way that we can tell it and put this truth on the record, then so be it. Mm-hmm. So you have that conversation, the sources, and yeah, and there, you know, it's sort of a, it's interesting because in education now, I feel like the floodgates have been opened and now everyone wants to talk as long as they're protected. Which I don't know what, you know, there are two sides of every coin, right? So it's great that we're able to share these stories now, but it definitely is, I wonder what that'll look like in the future. People will ever be willing to go back on the record when they have justifiable critiques. I think it's important that people do speak out, but obviously it isn't without risks. So that's tough too.
Yeah, that's what I'm curious about, because is this an example of the moment was so unique that people had to speak out because they were seeing so many new things? Or have these stories always been there? There's always been these big issues out there that people didn't even think they could talk about, but this is the moment where they realize, oh, I do have a way to have a voice. And like, that's just who knows, we'll see what happens, I guess.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. If it's tough because there are a lot of variables with, obviously I've been covering sort of city stories for a while, and then I finally switched over to education in January, and so I am just sort of starting to, I don't know what the right word is, to make a name for myself, but I think people in the education system are like, oh, okay, you know, maybe I've talked to them, or a colleague has talked to me, or I talk to a lot of people. So I think that people start to send me notes and I get more tips and that sort of thing. And I wonder, is that because people just know, oh, someone is in the province actually dedicated to covering education and word gets out? Or is it because the pandemic is pushing people to reach out and share their frustration? So it'll be interesting to see in the next year. I mean, we are in for another very tumultuous year in Manitoba education. Who knows when that education review is coming out and all the lasting inequities that the pandemic has highlighted. I mean, it's going to be another tumultuous year, chaotic year, I'm sure.
Yeah. Do you have any predictions what the big stories for this year is going to be? Like, there's the review, there's pandemic stuff. Is there big things aside from that you think are going to be the big stories of the year, or is that what will dominate 2021?
I think that there's going to be a lot of talk about recovery learning, because there are already these two sides and there's a lot of tension there. We keep hearing educators who say, you know, our kids are so far behind. And there was a new research from the University of Alberta, from George Giorgio over there, who is a professor who has been looking into literacy rates. And what he's found is that students who are in grade 1 to 3, particularly struggling readers, have seen some real decline in their literacy skills since the learning disruptions in the spring. And interestingly, in grade 4 and up, it seems that students have actually fared quite well, and they have either improved or remained around the same level when it comes to their reading. Mm-hmm. And so his perspective is, our kids are behind. We need to have interventions now to catch them up. And that's one side. And I hear that a lot. And then there's also the other side, which is, you know, what are our kids behind? How can we say that they're behind? And this other side, I guess, argues that we need to change the finish line, adjust the finish line, and adjust our expectations. And I wonder if that is too optimistic. I don't know. It'll be very interesting. But I do think that this conversation about kids being behind, how are we going to catch them up, or do we redraw finish lines? That's definitely going to be a tension that carries forward into this year, into 2021, probably 2022. That conversation is not going away. I think also conversations about arts education will be interesting this year, and what that looks like, because I did a little feature a little while ago just about how high school students in particular have been able to really express themselves through art this year. But we've also seen that some schools have had to cut back some of their arts programming because there had to be this focus or some educators chose to have this focus on math, STEM, these sort of core classes to get kids caught up. So I think it all really is going to come down to that. Are kids behind? How do we catch them up? That tension there. The other thing too is just this conversation about what is the future of remote learning, and is there a future of remote learning in the province?
Mm-hmm.
Because we've seen that a lot of students have struggled, but there has been, I guess, a small percentage of students who have really thrived in remote learning, and perhaps that's because of anxieties at school, lots of other reasons. So that'll be interesting to see what does that look like.
It's you mentioned being, you know, young and wanting to go into journalism, which I suspect is rare these days.
Foolish, yeah.
but I think part of that is because it's not even a problem or a perception of news. I think the way schools have changed their focus on literacy, I think schools talk less about media and what media does and why media is important. So if teachers were going to be talking about journalism in class, what do you think they should be paying attention to if they want to, you know, teach media literacy? What in all the things you do, what should maybe a high school be thinking about if they're looking closely at studying the news?
Well, I think the key underlying pillars, I guess, of journalism, accuracy, honesty, empathy, those are all things to keep in mind as anytime you're consuming journalism, to sort of assess whether or not it's good journalism or perhaps poor journalism. I obviously am an advocate for getting kids to read the newspaper. I think that there's something so special about reading the newspaper versus reading an online story, because they're packaged so differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also, though, it's important to question everything you read. So it really comes down to media literacy when we're thinking about it and talking to students about it. I think it comes down to reading and just asking questions. And I think that that's what journalists do, and that's what readers should do too, right? When they're reading journalism of any kind, is to ask questions and to think critically about who's being quoted, about the different facts, about attribution. Now, I think that when you read good journalism, like, you can, you know, see the honesty and the empathy in the writing and the accuracy.
I'm glad you mentioned the physical versus online. You got to get the free press, send newspapers back to schools. They stopped doing that. This should be a thing.
Oh, really? I don't know what that setup is. Like, I know that
it was,
I'm not sure.
Maybe, I don't know, like 7 years ago, you could apply and get like 25 papers every day for your school. And then that stopped, and it's an online portal now,
which is
much harder to use. Anyway, yes, newspapers in schools. As you talked about, like, a very sophisticated idea of what news is, I thought about what it probably looks like when teachers do it. How often do you think about the five W's? Are those elementary teachers or whoever is teaching that, are they completely misguided to be talking about that with their students? Is that overly simplistic?
No, I think that I think that because I write so often that it sort of just subconsciously I always think about them.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think here. What are even the five W's? Who, what, where, when, why, and then how, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the lead. No, I think that's a really good basic way to ground journalism and to start thinking about it. Those are all, you know, important things. In the lead, in the nut graph, which is the line after the lead or a couple lines later, that sort of explains and contextualizes the story.
Mm-hmm.
That's still a good grounding, a good solid foundation for understanding media literacy.
I just visualize the handout that would go with that, and it makes me cringe a bit, but I'm sure there's a way someone could do that.
Yeah, there are five boxes, right?
Yeah, that's
five
right.
Boxes. Yeah, yeah. I definitely wrote my first news story that way too, I would think, in grade 10 or whatever that was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always ask teachers to recommend something to their colleagues, you know, a reading or an experience or, you know, a video. And I'm wondering if it's something you'd recommend to teachers, maybe something that would make them better teachers, or maybe something that would give them insight into what you do. So what would be your recommendation for a teacher?
I think that I would say, if you haven't already, then to review the Community Education Development Association's State of Equity reports. Because I think that is also going to be something that we'll be talking about a fair bit in the new year. When I stepped into this role, one of the things that I had told my editors that I wanted to do was look at, you know, who is making our curriculum, who is teaching our curriculum, who is being reflected in our resources. And I think that is a conversation we're going to continue to have as we talk about what equity looks like in the classroom. I mean, it's, you know, quite obvious that the majority of Manitoba teachers are white.
Yeah.
And being a white journalist, it's something that I think about constantly as I'm reporting and the place of privilege that I come from. So I think that as a good place to start is reading those State of Equity reports, which came out last fall. And I guess just thinking about what that looks like in the classroom and how to talk to students about equity. I know that in all the teacher pages that I'm in, there are a lot of educators who are thinking critically about the resources they have in their classrooms. But I definitely think it's worth looking at those two reports. There's one on, I think it's a State of Equity report. It's based on Indigenous educators. And then there's another one that is on newcomers. And those are two that were put out, I think it was October.
Cool.
So yeah, I would recommend, if you haven't read those already, then those are good good documents to skim.
Maggie, thank you so much for talking to me, but also for all what you are doing. Like, it's nice to see the stories out there, not just the happy stories. I'm glad that we're all thinking about education again. So thank you for that, and thank you for talking with me.
Well, thanks for making the time, and thanks for reading, Devin. Truly, it has been a year that I could never have ever imagined in education reporting, and I'm sure that there'll be lots more to come, especially with the Manitoba Education Modernization Act and what that looks like, or rather the Public Schools Modernization Act, I think it's called.
That's what we call starting off 2021 with a bummer. So thanks, Maggie.
Well, a bummer or a bang, however you want to think about it. It's going to be a very interesting year in Manitoba schools. And yeah. I look forward to writing about it.